The scenes in Alice Springs yesterday were horrific, unacceptable, and we never want to see anything like that again in the Northern Territory.
Hold all traffic on the Key Bridge. There's a ship approaching that just lost their steering.
The moments before disaster unfolded.
Oh my gosh!
Donald Trump has been given something of a lifeline by an appeals court in New York.
This is all about election interference. This is all Biden-run things.
The Princess of Wales, Catherine, has revealed that she's been treated for cancer.
She's got three young children. I mean, imagine how that's been for her. I could get quite upset just thinking about it.
The United Nations Security Council has passed a resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza.
Question is, do you support Israel or do you support Hamas, Andy? That's the question.
Back home, the federal government's failed to rush its new immigration laws through Parliament today, with the Senate delaying a vote on the bill until May.
No more lectures from you on national security or strengthening our borders.
In a shock announcement, Byron Bay's famous Splendour in the Grass Music Festival has been cancelled just days after tickets went on sale.
Suppliers' costs are going up, the operators' costs are going up, and that increases ticket prices.
No, it's not Friday, it's Thursday, but we're treating this as the end of the working week, as it is for me. I hope it is for you too. Joining me to chew over some of the week's big stories is Warramai man, Professor Dean Sanders, lead partner of Deloitte Integrity and adjunct professor of law at Newcastle University. Great to have you back, Dean.
Yeah, how are you, Bill, Andy? Good to see you.
And Dr. Abel Rizvi, columnist and former Deputy Secretary of the Department of Immigration. Great to have you as well, Abel.
G'day, Andy.
Let's start with the pretty dramatic developments in Central Australia in the recent days, with the imposition of a nighttime curfew on children under 18 in Alice Springs. This is in response to a violent riot, I guess you would call it, which broke out on Tuesday. As it happens, most of the people arrested over this have actually been adults. The NT government says it will deploy more police to the town. There's also been calls for a federal intervention, with the Alice Springs mayor telling me yesterday that the territory government cannot be relied on to fix this. Dean, I want to ask you, I mean, you're rightly very distressed about this. I know you'll talk about some deeper context that is perhaps being overlooked here. But I just want to ask you, this is the question that was pervading my text line last hour, and I want to ask this as sensitively and with as much empathy as I can, but this is what people are asking me. I want to ask you, what about parents and what about elders in the community? Where is the set level of responsibility in this? Can I ask that?
Oh, look, I think that's a very big question, Andy. I think responsibility is a sacred and profound element of Aboriginal culture. I have no doubt that the elders and the parents of that community are feeling deeply responsible. I also have no doubt that they don't know how to exercise that. They're not given permission or voice or power or authority to be able to exercise that properly. This is something we're seeing across many of our systems, where communities are fractured, communities are challenged, they're hollowed out by loss, by sadness, by disadvantage, and that does erode at the sort of role and capacity of our elders.
I think it's been clear for some time that curfews don't or can't work in the long term, and I don't think anyone is suggesting that this curfew is the one and only fix for the social troubles, particularly with young people in Alice Springs. But did authorities have any choice, do you think, to impose this as a circuit breaker?
Oh, look, I do think that curfews play an interesting role in acting as a circuit breaker. I think it's right to understand that they're not a solution. Communities do need moments of pause. It's certainly the case that communities can get caught up, all communities, this is not an Indigenous story, all communities can get caught up in the moment, in the challenges of those moments, and the fear and the need to express that anger and that frustration. So curfews, I think, do work there. I really think it's important that we don't understand or we don't assume that's a curfew will solve all of these problems. These are much deeper. They won't solve the problems for the Aboriginal people or the Indigenous people of Alice Springs, the Arenda people, who have their own voice on this too, and I'd love to hear more from that community. It's important that I clarify that I'm speaking not as an Arenda person, and so it's important that their voices are heard in this conversation too. But I have no doubt that they are of the view that a curfew might be helpful, even themselves, to solve some element of the moment, but that they are looking for a bigger conversation, a deeper set of solutions for their community.
This wasn't just about a funeral. There was obviously a deeper context in terms of unemployment, housing, services, a directionless youth has been described in the paper. Tell me about some of these contexts that have led to, and I appreciate you say you're not from Alice Springs and I don't expect for you to have a deep understanding, but I think you can see a mirror in some other communities that we're seeing that same reflection in what's happening in Alice Springs today.
Well, I think if we do reflect on the fact that this is not a story of a particular place, it is an exaggerated story of place for reasons I think that have been canvassed in different media stories about the particular behaviours of governments over the most recent years. But this is a story, Andy, that's not just about that. It is, of course, a story that's 240 years in the making. This is the consequence of a history of exclusion, a history of voicelessness. Even those elements you talked about in terms of directionless youth, they were your words, they are a consequence too of what is lost, what has been lost, what is missing in the conversations we go forward. How do we engage our youth in culture, in direction, in purpose? That's a whole of community issue, a whole of, not just Indigenous community, a whole of community issue. You know, how do we re-engage those issues? I'm struggling a little with the conversation that we hear in the last sort of 48 hours around from the non-Indigenous community, the non-Arunda peoples of that space talking about things like antisocial behaviour. And I keep wrestling with this word antisocial because I keep wondering, you know, what does that really mean when there is some universal principle of society, as a one in which we all share this equally? I'm not sure that's true for the Arunda people of Alice Springs. I mean, who's social? Are they being anti to? Is it the society that they are excluded from? Is it the culture they're disrespected by? I think there's a big conversations. And I noted your earlier point that's coming up in PM about this being a conversation that extends beyond just the Northern Territory into youth crime elsewhere. I think it's the conversation we need to be having as a nation. And it's a 240-year conversation that we've been missing.
Abul, once again, this has prompted calls for people in Canberra to do something, to intervene or to send in more law enforcement. But you'd have to say that hasn't really worked up until now. Would it work on this occasion?
I doubt it. I know the word intervention implies a punishment approach to this issue. And I think if we've learned nothing in this space, and we probably haven't learned a lot, it's that punishment doesn't work. We learnt that from 30 years ago from the Aboriginal Deaths in Custody Royal Commission, many of the recommendations of which are still to be implemented. I think what this highlights to me is the importance of the voice. The voice would have given us an opportunity to develop policies where the lead is with Indigenous Australians who know and understand their communities and could have guided us into policies that had a chance to work. Instead, we are stuck with the way we have done this for years and years and years, and my fear is the call for intervention will simply lead to more calls for punishment, which has always failed in this space.
I want to move on to perhaps another wicked problem in terms of Australian society and the way that we look after the vulnerable, you might say. The government's continued folly with immigration legislation. This is in the wake of last year's High Court decision, which declared the asylum seekers could not be kept in indefinite detention. This is a political hot potato because many of those released into the community following this ruling have committed very serious crimes, but they've also served their time and in many instances can't be returned to their countries of origin. Now, the government is trying to force the matter with new legislation which failed to pass this week. The coalition teaming up with the Greens to, well, the coalition at least punish Labor over their handling of this and forcing it into another committee and another vote in May at the earliest. Abel, this really is the latest attempt to deal with this cohort of people and it does seem like a pretty extreme kind of tool to deal with it, potentially blocking off immigration from entire countries. This has been labelled as even Trumpist. Surely it's a good thing that it has been referred to a Senate committee for review.
I think rushed legislation should always be referred to a committee for review. So I think in principle that's absolutely the right thing to do. The other thing to understand is this problem, whilst it's come to a head in the last 6 months, has been around for at least 30 years. I recall being sent by the government in early 2000s to Iran to negotiate with the Iranian government to change their policies about accepting returnees who were refusing to return. So this has been around for 30 odd years at least, where firstly the detainee doesn't wish to cooperate in their removal. That's understandable. They don't want to go back. And the Iranian government doesn't wish to cooperate with the Australian government. It's quite radical legislation, no question about that. But I suspect that perhaps with a few minor, relatively minor carve-outs, the coalition will support this legislation and it will become law. The question then is, will it work?
Do you think the coalition will ultimately support those laws or will we see more mischief-making and politicking?
Oh, there'll be mischief-making and politicking. I mean, that goes without saying. but ultimately, they will agree to this.
Dean, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this because at the centre of this whole story, and I know it's a sort of an incremental story and has acronyms and detention legislation, but I think at the centre of it, we're talking about fairness and safety. What do you make of all this wrangling over these detainees?
Look, I do think you're right, Andy, to call it out in the broader sense of what this is about. I noted Abel's commentary about 30 years. I mean, without wanting to sound as though I'm kicking the same can, I actually think it's a little longer than that, probably a couple of hundred years if I think it through properly. But we haven't done immigration so well in this country since any of our people can remember. But I would argue that point you make is a powerful one, that this becomes the worst of us when it becomes a politicking issue, when it becomes about how do we negotiate for the worst outcomes rather than imagine what the best ones might be. I'm sort of leaning on the side of the fact that certainly to your point about whether the Senate needs to give consideration to this differently and we should be proud of that, I think that is true. I personally believe that Parliament exists to give consideration to things deeply. Irrelevant of the politics of the moment and the challenges. And personally, if I'm wanting to be optimistic and the principle of charity here for government is that they too want this negotiated properly rather than hastily, because hasty legislation is always problematic. So I think it's important that we think about this in the bigger sense of that. I prefer a government and a parliament that's listening, that's thinking deeply through things rather than just reacting and running scared at things. I'd be a little bit more strident to say that the challenge or the fun and games of politics that worries me more. That worries me deeply. That this is a pattern of behaviour we're getting into in this country, where we seem to want to fight with the worst of each other to arrive at the worst of our outcomes, rather than to imagine better ones. That's an important principle that I think we lost sight of a couple of hundred years ago. I'm not quite sure why we are not able to see our way through that now.
It's 20 past five. You're listening to RN Drive. We're wrapping the week this Thursday for a change with Warramai man, Professor Dean Sanders and Dr. Abel Rizvi. We really are tackling the big issues head on this afternoon, immigration, Indigenous issues, and now population. I spoke last hour to Shane Wright, the economics columnist with The Age and Sydney Morning Herald. He's been crunching the latest ABS data. Fascinating issues to do with the declining birth rate, the increasing death rate, and the record high level of immigration. I think the highest single year percentage intake of migrants since the Menzies era. We know that our immigration levels are high, but then when you think about to get to another sort of shock when it comes to international students, despite the government trying to reduce the size of this cohort. Talk to me about your estimations when you look at the data about how many or how much of that net migration is to do with students.
So in 2022, 67% of net migration was students. In 2022-23, just over 50% of net migration was students. This is fundamentally, the big surge in net migration is fundamentally a students' issue.
So that has an interesting bearing on the housing debate. There was a text last hour saying, you know, people, international students aren't moving into greenfield sites and five-bedroom homes in prime agricultural land. They're moving into the inner city because that's where the study is. Do you think that if that is understood more widely, that these debates would be had in a different tone?
I think so. I think what people have not understood is that the three big drivers of net migration have been students, which, as you say, Andy, generally live near the CBDs of our major cities, usually in apartments, often in student accommodation, The second big driver is actually visitors extending stay, and many of those would be family visitors who are extending stay with family. And the third big driver is working holiday makers who tend to stay in backpacker accommodation. So whilst I think there's undoubtedly added pressure from the high rate of net migration to housing, I think we are overplaying that card.
Dean, you're a partner at Deloitte. I'm curious about what sort of conversations you have in the business world about population and migration, because I think the stereotype, or perhaps the misnomer, is that business wants workers and will stop at nothing to get them. Is the focus on getting the much-needed skilled workers into this country, or is business realising some of these social fallouts that we're experiencing?
Oh, look, I think, Andy, that there's always an economic framing to these types of questions, and it's an important one, but it's also arguably not sufficient to the argument. I mean, this country, frankly, as we know, has largely grown, frankly, our main economic growth comes from, frankly, digging things up or bringing people in. That's pretty much it. That's what this country has done a very good job of. So if we're not digging things up, or rather the market for that is differing or changing over time, and bringing people in has been our primary growth, then we have to ask ourselves different questions about how we might grow economically in the future. Business is very interested in that. I think it's interesting, Abul speaks to the idea that it's the net migration number that I think was a powerful one, his statement, because as we know, net migration could be changed by changing other metrics in the number. So the issue of students or other forms of temporary worker-style structures, it's only a problem because they represent a larger number of who else might be coming in. The real economic question around population is, what skills do we need? Who do we need? Who is our nation in the future? How do we grow as an economy, bringing different skills and talent, capability, care? I think these are the bigger questions we need to be asking ourselves. The absence of that conversation means that we are focusing on, I think, the outliers of the debate rather than facing the middle of it.
Yeah, I mean, Abul, we know the government has set a goal. I don't think we're allowed to call it a target. That wouldn't be very good politics, because you're always going to miss a target. So a goal of reducing net migration to 235,000 by 2027. How are they going to do that?
Well, at the moment, their focus has been almost entirely on reducing student numbers. And I would say two things about what they have done in terms of reducing student numbers. The first is, the majority of things they have done is reverse a range of policies that they inherited. So, for example, unlimited work rights for students, the old COVID visa, fee-free applications for students, those sorts of things have been reversed. In addition, the government has tightened up on education providers who were perhaps more in the business of selling visas than in the business of selling education. That is all a good thing. But having done all of that, the government still has failed to achieve two things. One, it hasn't done enough to get net migration down to the numbers that it says it wants. And we can have a separate debate as to whether those forecasts are the right forecasts or not. That's a separate matter. But the second thing it's failed to do is, despite the very high level of immigration, we haven't filled the key skill needs that we've known have existed for a long time.
Like what? You know, I think the example of you don't get, we're not bringing in people from India to be tradespeople because there's a high degree of localised skill assessment and endorsement. Yes. So what exactly do you mean? What industries are you talking about?
There are four key industries that have been in shortage, and we've known that they would be in shortage for a long, long time. This is not new. This is not a surprise to government. We've known we were going to have a shortage in the health and aged care area with the ageing of the population and the crisis in our health and aged care systems with a shortage of workers in those areas. We knew this was coming, and we knew this was coming a long time ago. We've also had a significant shortage in education, and that may be more a function of low pay and those sorts of issues. I'm not sure, but we've certainly had a long-term shortage of teachers. Three, we've had a long-term shortage of IT workers, people in the full range of IT areas, simply because not enough Aussies were doing IT at university and at vet. And the fourth area is in the traditional construction trades, where we knew the shortage was coming because we had a huge bulge of baby boomer tradies. Now, baby boomer tradies are predominantly in their 60s or 70s now, and I'm not sure they can keep working as carpenters, bricklayers, plumbers, electricians for a lot longer. So the shortage we're facing now of construction workers is not going to get better anytime soon. And we recruit very few people from overseas in the construction trades, simply because, as you say, our skills recognition arrangements don't really work for the vast majority of the world. They only work for the Western world. If we're going to get more skilled tradies, we're going to have to divert some of those students into doing trades courses rather than doing business and commerce degrees.
Yeah, and I wonder what the Master Builders Association would say about that. I want to move on, and I know that you know that this is a safe space. I don't mind confessing to this, but I am just a little bit obsessed with a certain men's club that's become something of a sleeper hit on Facebook. It's called the Dull Men's Club, and I say that with the most dull intonation I can. I should add that there is also a Dull Women's Club, so, you know, you really have to see it to believe it, but it really is essentially a shrine to all things of ordinary middle-aged men and women. Here are a few examples of posts. 44-year-old Chris celebrating having fixed his garage door. Billy, a 22-year-old plumber who finds joy utilising existing fittings. It's as boring as watching rain fall on wet carpet. And he describes this as hitting the lottery. My dull man activity is checking the rain gauge every morning. I don't know why, but I do, even if it hasn't rained. What's your dull man activity? Go. Abel, you're first.
I'm first. Oh, rain gauge checking. Of course, you would recall the famous Monty Python sketch about Eric Orthwaite, I assume. He was also into, I think, brass taps and shovels. He called them, shovels.
What about you, Dean, your dull man activity? What is it
I'm pleased you took us here, Andy. I was worried it was going to be one of those afternoons where everything is racism. So this is a much more fun conversation. But look, I have to admit that was it Chris? I think Chris might be some sort of soulmate there. I was just thinking through that I've just repaired a door, in fact, downstairs that had a handle missing. And I've got to admit that every time I walk past it now, I give it a little jiggle.
Sense of
and
satisfaction.
Feel immensely impressed with myself.
Yes.
Exactly. I'm re-impressed every time I walk past it with how amazing I was at simply taking a door handle off and re-screwing it back on.
Let's celebrate the small wins. Warramai man, Professor Dean Sanders, lead partner at Deloitte and adjunct professor at law in Newcastle University, Dr. Abel Rizvi. Always a pleasure to have you both. Have a wonderful Easter, and thanks for your time.
Good on you, Andy.
Stream any ABC radio station live and on the go. Discover new podcasts, music and audiobooks, all free on the ABC Listen app.